Welcome to the podcast, where we challenge conventional thinking and explore fresh, forward-looking perspectives on leadership. Whether you're a seasoned executive or an aspiring leader, join us on a journey to uncover the complexities of modern leadership. Because leadership itself may not change, but the way we think about it is constantly evolving. This is Rethinking Leadership, a podcast by T. Yas Business School, hosted by Executive Professor Rumer Visser.
Today, my guest is Dr. Barry Posner. Barry is the Akolte Endowed Professor of Leadership at the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara University. He's been recognized as one of the top 50 leadership coaches in America, ranked among the most influential HR thinkers in the world by HR Magazine, and listed among the top 75 leadership and management experts in the world by Inc. magazine. He's the co-author, together with Jim Kouzes, of the best-selling leadership book called The Leadership Challenge, of which more than 3 million copies have been sold, and he has published more than 100 articles in the world's top-tier academic journals. He's worked with organizations such as Amazon, Applied Materials, IKEA, Northrop Grumman, and Petronas, among many others, and has spoken all over the world. Barry, a warm welcome to this podcast.
Rumer, thank you. Thanks for the nice introduction.
You're very welcome. So I'm curious about sort of the backstory, sort of the origin story. You have this amazing, you know, body of work that you've done, a lot of which, of course, with Jim Kouzes, but also, you know, what is it, 40, 50 years of research on leadership. You have a bachelor's degree in political science. So tell me about how you got started on this leadership track.
Well, there's two parts to the story. First of all, I should say personally, it goes back to being a first generation college student. But my parents owned a small shoe store in Southern California, and after school daycare for my brother and I involved coming to the store. And when we were younger, sitting in the back doing our homework. And then as we got older, we could clean the bathrooms, we could stock the shelves, we could write out invoices. Eventually, we could wait on customers. And I'd say I learned about leadership first through customer service, through serving others, for listening to what it was that other people wanted, and then trying to figure out what I could do to fill their needs. And in this case, it was through shoes. But the principles were still the same. What is it that people need, and how can I, as a servant leader, how can I be most persuasive by trying to figure out what they need and finding a solution to their needs? And I didn't think about that as leadership at that point. But when I look back upon the thread of my life, certainly that's important. It would come later in my professional life when my doctoral dissertation was really around culture and values, studying a large nationwide company that had multiple locations all selling the same products, and wondering why were some more successful than others. And as you parsed out geography or demographics, we found out that really the most successful organizations, all selling the same products, all with the same rules and regulations, were ones in which, and no matter what level they were in the organization, everyone at every level felt they had more influence in the high-performing units, locations, than did those in the lower-performing locations. Even though they were branch managers by title, some branch managers felt that their regional vice presidents gave them more influence, or they had more influence with those people. Yeah. That values literature would eventually, in a collaboration with Jim Kouzes at Santa Clara University, we were doing a 2-day program on leadership in February 1983. So more than 40 years ago. And the first day was being done by a young man. We were all younger then, but by a young man named Tom Peters.
Yeah.
And Tom and Bob Waterman had written a book that had come out in November of 1982 called In Search of Excellence. And Tom did the first day of the workshop, taking a look at, well, what is it that makes for an excellent organization? And a lot of that had to do with the leadership at the top of the organization. If you were the CEO, if you were Jack Welch, if you were Bruce Nordstrom, this is what This is what you could do to set a culture of your organization. But the people who were in our program here in Silicon Valley, 40 talented people, but none of them ran their organizations. They were general managers. They were division managers. They were certainly influential, but they couldn't just because of by their title, couldn't change the organization. So Jim and I had the challenge the second day of sort of asking the question, okay, well, if you're not the CEO, what does it mean to lead an organization and to create an excellent organization? And we stumbled upon the question. So tell us about a time you had been at your personal best as a leader. And that question has continued to be important to us in our research for more than 40 years, our research and other people's research, both originally qualitatively. We asked the 40 people in the room, well, take 10 minutes and think about a time you've been at your personal best as a leader. And what did you do? What were the things that really made a difference? Get into small groups and talk about those and see if you can come up with some consistencies, some consensus around the things that were important, whether you were in a public utility, you were in a regional bank, you were in a high-tech company. And, you know, each group came back, presented their reports, and then we looked at all the landscape there and we said, so now still, what are still the big ideas that come out of all of these experiences, some of which were 10 years ago and some of which were, you know, just weeks ago. And that really was the origin of finding what we now call the five practices of exemplary leadership. Though in fairness, we had seven, and that day we came up with seven, and we would spend the afternoon revisiting with the group each one of those seven ideas, thinking about their practical applications. We would do that, Jim and I would do that for several years until we felt that we'd collected enough stories and heard enough to be able to say, well, we keep hearing these things. We never claimed to explain 100% of the variance, but it seemed that what was true in every case of extraordinary achievements were that people did at least these five things and did them well. We would follow that up several years later with an opportunity to go into, what then was a relatively new organization. Today is one of the top 10 companies in the world. We had a chance to go in and develop a quantitative instrument, which we call the Leadership Practices Inventory, in which we took the behaviors that were part of the five practices. And again, initially we had 50 behaviors. And we went in and we had a chance to study within a real organization with real people and real data. And we would eventually come up with 30 behaviors, six behaviors for each one of those five practices, which significantly differentiated between high and low performers who were running relatively similar organizations. Now we've had, Romer, we've had, you know, more than 5 million people have completed that instrument. We get 200,000 to 300,000 people every year that complete that instrument. So both qualitatively and quantitatively, we have a lot of confidence that it's not perfect. You know, but if you do these five things, you're going to significantly increase the likelihood, the probability that you're going to be successful. And it's all kind of behaviorally based. It's not a think system. It's a behavior. You know, it's a treating people with dignity and respect. And our instrument simply asks people to the question, well, how frequently does this leader engage in this behavior? Not how well do they do it? How much would you like them to do it?
Oh, so this is a 360.
Yeah. Yeah,
because the first instrument was basically self-report. Right?
The first time we did it was self-report, but now in all the studies that we report, all the empirical data that we report and the data that we report in the book, is all from observers. This is what the constituents say of their leaders when. The more frequently my leader does these things, then then the more proud I am to tell people I work for this organization, the more committed I am to this organization's success, the more likely I would recommend this person as a good leader to other people. I mean, the curves are quite different between those who are doing this, you know, often, very often, and those who are doing this seldom or rarely.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Gallup's data that suggests that up to, I think, 70% of the variance in employee engagement is determined by the supervisor.
Yeah, and in that case, it's just, you know, the way they measure engagement is different than the way we sure. measure something we call positive workplace attitudes. And gotcha. Then we say that's our measure of engagement.
Yeah, but I think the message here is don't underestimate the impact that you have.
Well, absolutely. Well, you know, our point is that, you know, it's like you make a difference.
Yeah, exactly.
You matter. You know, how you behave makes more difference than whether the people who work for you are tall or short, thick or thin, smile or don't smile, are in engineering, accounting, finance, you know, they're in California or they're in England. You know, that's not what matters. What matters is how you behave.
Got it. And so those five practices of leadership, it looks like they've been pretty stable over the years. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You know, we just published last year the seventh edition of the Leadership Challenge, and the question I most likely get asked is, what's new?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't mean to be disappointing people. You know, the world is new, but the process of leadership is, in fact, in the last 2 years, we started asking some questions around hybrid workplaces. You know, you tell us about how your leader behaves, but then we might ask the question, are you in the same office as your leader? How frequently, you know, do you interact with your leader? Or what percentage of time do you work at home versus in the office? And just to make this very simple, in the last 2 years, the world has changed. And what we found is that those people who are working in remote or hybrid situations, that in fact, they have to engage in these five practices more frequently than we've had to in the past, more intentionally than we've had to in the past, because you're just not going to bump into people. You can't, yeah. You have to be more conscious and more conscientious about, about modeling the way, about inspiring a shared vision.
And just briefly for any of the listeners who are not familiar with the five practices, would you mind giving me a very quick run for
them? No, you mean people are not familiar with these five practices? Okay, sure. So, you know, and all of these are important. What people told us was that when they're at their personal best, we call it modeling the way.
Yep.
No one said they modeled the way. They said, I was a role model. I set an example for others. I didn't ask people to do anything that I wouldn't do myself. I follow through on my promises. Those are the kinds of things we put under an umbrella, and we called it modeling the way.
Yep.
When people were at their personal best, they inspired a shared vision. Once again, no one said I inspired a shared vision. They said I had a vision. I had a burning passion. I was focused on the future. I got other people excited. I listened to others and reflected back the things that they said that were important to them. When people were at their personal best, they challenged the process. They did things differently. They experimented. They were willing to learn. They risked. They tried stuff out. When people were at their personal best, they talked about enabling others to act. They talked about building a team. They talked about getting close to people and knowing their talents and their interests and their desires. They talked about giving people discretion and latitude to make decisions and hold themselves accountable and trusting them. And when people were at their personal best, they encouraged the heart. Again, no one said I encouraged the heart. They said I rewarded individual excellence. I built a community. I made sure that we celebrated when we made progress and accomplished things. And I encouraged the heart tied back to the values and the model that we had set at the start, and sort of it all kind of came back together again. And all of that was true back in 1983, and was reiterated to me in the personal best of 26 executive MBA students that I'll be teaching next week. Their conclusions, as they fill out this 12-page questionnaire, their conclusions are going to be very, very consistent. And so the question we ask in the seminar is not so much that this is something that Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner discovered, but rather this is something you said you did when you were at your personal best. So how about if we spend some time thinking about how we could be doing these things more comfortably, more often, more gracefully?
Okay, great. Thank you for that. So these five leadership practices have withstood the test of time over the last 40 years.
Certainly.
And you also say they are really, you've been very intentional and clear about saying these are behavioral. And I just wanted to follow up with you on that, because I'm just kind of curious how this fits, or if this fits. So if you say treat with respect, I can act in a friendly way, but inside I may feel angry or annoyed, right? I can show certain behaviors that do not align with my inner state. And when you say that, this is behavioral, you just got to do this, you run the risk at least of glossing over that inner state. But so yeah, go ahead.
Well, in psychology, we continue to have this debate about whether attitudes create behavior or behavior creates attitudes. And certainly in your comment, we know that when there's a disconnect in whichever direction it is, when there's a disconnect, it's hard. It's hard,
yeah.
It's hard physically and psychologically. We took the view, Jim and I took the viewpoint that really, if we could influence people's behavior, their attitudes would follow, particularly when the behavior garnered them positive results. So, when you treat people with dignity and respect and you get it and they do the same back to you, well, that's reinforcing.
Yep.
And if you don't trust people, so one of the things we talk about is how important it is for trust is that you've got to go first. You can't say to somebody else, hey, all you trust me when I tell you this. They really want to say, well, why should I trust you?
Yeah.
And my response is, you should trust me because I trust you. You tell me. You tell me what is it that we should be doing together. And in the same way that any coach of an athletic team, for example. When the team wins, it's the team. And when the team loses, it's the coach.
Yeah.
That's what a good coach does.
Yeah. Yeah. Leader goes first. So basically what you're saying is we're not sort of negating the importance of the inner state, but we're trusting that at some level it'll follow if you build this pattern around the behavior that tends to work.
Yeah. I mean, what we're saying is when people behave this way,
yeah,
you get positive results.
Yeah.
It speaks across the other dimension, the other personality dimension of kind of being introspective or introvert, being an introvert or an extrovert. Jim, my colleague, Jim is an extrovert. I'm really actually more of an introvert.
Mm-hmm.
But in the role of a leader, when I'm the dean of the school, when I'm the chairman of the department, then when I go, When I was the dean, you know, and in a large or in a large gathering, I would go up to people and shake their hand because that was my role. When I go to that large gathering as a faculty member, I'm not going around introducing myself, shaking people's hands and saying who I am. I'm happy for people to come up to me and say that. That's my state. But if I'm somehow the leader in that organization, in that gathering, then I've got to behave in a way that is consistent with that. So,
yeah, makes sense. And I'm most curious with a follow-up question here. One of my observations, critiques of leadership research, that at least the academic discipline, is, you know, 120-year history of scholarly research on leadership, and we still don't have a commonly accepted definition. Do you find that you, when you talk about leadership, that you have sort of adopted a definition for yourself?
Well, we have two definitions. We share, like you do. We'll say, you know, there are hundreds of definitions of leadership. The one that we use, we say that, you know, that the that leadership. Well, let me take the simple. I don't need to give you one more definition of leadership, but if I put it back in a behavioral perspective, I can ask you, how do you know if somebody's a leader? Mm-hmm. And eventually the answer to that is because they have followers.
Yes.
Right? And so that's how we know that somebody's a leader. Now we can ask the question, well, what is it they have to do that earns them, that would make people want to follow you? And so part of, if you will, leadership development is to try to understand then what are people looking for in their leaders. We started a study back in 1980 in which we, that was another question we asked. We asked 5,000 managers across the United States, what were the personal traits or characteristics you most looked for in somebody that you'd be willing, important word, willing to follow?
Yeah.
It was an open-ended question, and they could say whatever they wanted. We followed that study up the following year by asking several thousand people who worked for the federal government in the United States the same question. We eventually took all of the various things that people said, and now we have a 21 categories, and ask people now in our surveys to sort of say, of these 21, what are the 7 that are most important to you? You don't have to rank order them. But what we find, what we found consistently over 30 years now, 40 years, get my math right, what we found is that there's 4 characteristics people look for in people that they'd be willing to follow. And it doesn't make a difference whether we ask the question in Africa or America or Europe or Asia, or we ask frontline people or senior people. There are 4 things that people want. And I'm not telling you that people always get them, but the thing that people most want in their leaders is they want somebody that, you know, we use the word honest. And then there's some synonyms: has integrity, is truthful, you can trust them. But it's pretty clear to sort of say that if this is your level of motivation and you find that somebody's lied to you, it's clear what happens to your level of motivation. So I can't promise you that everybody's going to be honest, but we certainly hope that the people we're going to follow are telling us the truth. And the second thing we look for consistently is we look for people who are, the word we use is competent. And again, intelligent, smart, bright. You know, again, nobody wants to, if I'm going to follow you, I want to believe that you know what you're talking about. So you don't have to be the smartest person in the room, but on the topic that we're talking about, you know, it's like if I'm asking, you know, kind of how's my heart doing, I want to talk to a doctor. I don't want to talk to a plumber. And so I want people that are honest and competent, and those are, you know, you find those are very, very important in any personal relationship. In a marriage, you want to believe that your partner is telling you the truth. and, you know, and they know what they're talking about, whatever the subject is. The other things that are true is we want people. We want people who are forward looking. If we're going to follow somebody, we want somebody that has a point of view, has a sense of direction. Nobody really wants to come with me. I have no idea where we're going, but would you like to sign up? Well, that's not a good marketing strategy. Not everybody's going to want to go where you go. I mean, you know, and politicians know that you only need to have one more vote than the other person. So yeah, you don't need everybody's vote. And the fourth characteristic is inspiring, energetic, enthusiastic, positive, uplifting. Nobody wants to follow somebody. You don't want to do a podcast with somebody that's dull, boring, tired, has no energy. Right. I mean, you know, they may have all those other characteristics, but in the end, we know that emotions are contagious. So if you're not excited about something, it's hard to imagine that anybody else can be excited.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that kind of goes back to that inner state, right? This communication at a level, maybe call it subconscious level, this contagion effect, because I'd really want to highlight this point of it being a matter of the heart. Because it's very easy to take your work and translate it into sort of a checklist for 5 to-dos, you know? But when you give your work a closer read, I would argue you can't escape the question, why are you even in this? Right. And really, I'm speaking to the typical, if I use air quotes here, the typical mid-level manager, senior level manager who sort of ended up in that position where they're at because of a variety of reasons, but never necessarily set out to be a leader. And now they're concerned with, you know, meeting their KPIs and getting their bonuses and getting market share. I guess for some people really are passionate about that. They love just being in the game, and that's great. But there are also people, I would argue, who are not quite as passionate about their work, are maybe asking, you know, what's life about? They see your book and they think, oh, thank goodness, as long as I practice these 5, hone these 5 practices, I'll be effective. But when I think what you're saying is no, you have to have that. There's this quote in your book about being in love. As a leader, you have to be in love with your constituents, with your clients, your customers, your mission. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, sure. And you know that there's a difference between being a manager and a leader. And a lot of the, to your distinction, Romer, here, there are a number of people in those first level, second level, you know, who are managers.
Yeah.
And in fact, maybe very good managers.
Yeah.
And administrators and bureaucrats. Leadership is if you will, if you kind of take management, I mean, leadership is the value added quality that you bring to yourself and to the enterprise. Organizations can make you managers. The organization cannot make you a leader, even if it gives you a title. It doesn't make you a leader. It's one of the fundamental points that we make is that leadership is a relationship. And that's where you've got to put your heart into it. You know, it's not a contract. That's what managers have. They have a contract. I do this and therefore you do this and it's a transaction. Leadership is something more than that. It is personal. It's interpersonal for me, and it's intrapersonal. I mean, it's between us. And ideally, what we want to be able to do, just as, you know, the Chinese philosopher, you know, has said, is, you know, there they go. I'm their leader, but there they go. If you will, the moral quality that comes about in leadership is that leaders make other people more powerful, less dependent, more capable. I would oftentimes say to people, if you really want to get ahead in this organization, you've got to develop your people to take your job.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, the moral dimension to leadership, because all too often it is ignored, the directionality of it. You can win hearts and minds, but you can take them down a dark path, right?
Yes. I mean, we talked before about definitions of leadership. We talk about good and bad, moral and immoral, and kind of the, ends justifying the means and all the rest of that. For me, a big part of that morality is, see, I think we owe it. Leadership is a moral imperative. We owe it to others to make them better. That's back to my customer service days. What is it that you need, and what is it that I can do to help you get ahead, to make you successful?
That's okay. I love that. Thank you. And that brings up another point I wanted to mention. I've used your book, your and Jim's book, The Truth About Leadership, in one of my organization behavior courses. And I just wanted to share an anecdote with you, if that's okay. Excuse me. I had a woman in the course. She was in her early 40s. She had been working for a bank, her first employer, for close to 20 years. And she was assigned this book, and it turned out to turn her world upside down, because it turned out when she graduated college, she went through this sort of shrink wrap right process, this assessment of potential, et cetera, et cetera. And the results of that were, 18 years prior, you're very competent, you have lots of skills and talents, but leadership, we're not seeing it. We don't think that that's for you. And she accepted that as truth. And as a result, she never applied for any job. So it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. This book turned that her whole world upside down. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to tell you, the impact was much more than just cognitive. Yeah. She's no longer with the bank. She left the bank, and she is now in a supervisory or leadership, a formal leadership position. And so she was liberated from a constraint that was holding her back. And so I just wanted to, first of all, share that piece of feedback. Thank you for that.
Well, why does anyone write a book? You hope that there's somebody out there that in fact this will resonate with them. And you use this word, and it's one of the ones that we talk a lot on all of our writings and with the people that we work in leadership development, is how do you liberate the leader that's within every person? That's the challenge. That's my challenge. That's your challenge. I hope it's the challenge for all the people that are listening here. When we can do that, I think the time that we spend trying to make other people better only makes us better. And really, as a in an organizational sense, as a manager or whatever, at whatever level that is, I'm only successful based upon the success of the people who are below me. And the more successful I can make them, we all rise with that tide. And it's that kind of abundance mentality that I think leaders have. And I think that, too often, bad managers, let's just say, bad managers don't have an abundance mentality, have really a scarcity sort of notion that really I need to take all the credit. It really is all about me.
And let's take this. I know it's a hypothetical question, but let's say one of those people shows up in your courses. Or any course for that matter, what would the doctor prescribe to get them to switch to an abundance mentality, to release some of those constraints?
Yeah. Well, once again, the thing, the story that we found most compelling is to start for each person is to sort of say, so whenever you've been at your personal best, what did you do? what happened. And I find even in the you know, maybe like you, you know, you go into an organization, you don't know these people, you don't know much about the organization, and you're sort of hired to help them, you know, develop themselves. But there's always some people that are, skeptical. I've already been through a lot of these different things. And so I sort of start with this notion of, well, when you were at your best, when we were at our best, what were we doing? And so I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I want to reflect back to you. You know, I say, I'm just holding up a mirror to you and saying, in these five practices, I'm saying to you, I've just organized what it is that you've told me you're doing when you're at your personal best. So if that's the truth, and I'm only holding up your truth, then what is it that's holding you back from doing those things more? Well, my boss won't let me do it, the organization. Well, then, you know, we can explore the truth of that, the constraints about that. Not the least of which is, you know, just as you would say to others, maybe you're not in the right place. Maybe this isn't the place where you're going to be able to use all of your talents. And so it's not unusual that when I'm coaching an individual or working with a group of people, that there will be some folks who realize, just like the woman you told us about, realize the bank's not the right place for me. This isn't the right place for me. Yeah. And so the more I learn about myself and learn about what my talents and gifts are, then I need to find a place where I can make the most of those.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And so far we've talked mostly about your research, but you've also done a lot of work in organizations, with organizations. I'm kind of curious, you know, as you reflect on all the clients you've had and all the people that you've worked with, you know, are there particular, shall I say, for people going up the career ladder in the conventional sense of the word, are there any leadership transitions that you would say are particularly difficult or challenging more than others?
An interesting question, Romer. I think that the career development part of that question is like leaders, people need to be thinking further into the future than just their next job. They need to really be thinking about sort of, you know, pick a time frame depending upon when you start. But, you know, so in 10 years, in 20 years, I want to be a general manager. And why do I want to be a general manager? What is it about that position as I understand it today? What is it that makes me want to get to that level of responsibility or influence or budget or whatever it might be? And then to sort of say, so over these next 10 years, what are the things that I'm going to need to do that are going to be important to me when I'm that general manager? We were just, you know, at a restaurant recently, you know, talking with a young woman who was a chef there, who was aspiring to someday own her own restaurant. And so, you know, so as we were talking with her, it's like, so what do you need to, you know, what do you need to do? What, you know, can you learn everything you need to learn in, you know, as long as you stay in this restaurant, as long as you stay in this country, as long as you stay with this cuisine, whatever it might be? Where do you need to go to learn the kinds of things that are going to enable you to be able to have your own restaurant? And that's not going to happen in the next year. That's going to happen over a series of steps. I come back to answer your question a different way when I'm talking with, you know, college graduates or younger people. I talk to them about the importance of remaining curious. Curiosity doesn't necessarily always show up as a leadership characteristic, but it should, because I think that the best leaders are the best learners. And part of what influenced you to continue to learn is because you're curious about things you don't know. and about the way the world works, or about the way this product works, or this process works, or these people work, this culture works, and that causes you to be willing to move out of your comfort zone, to find out about things that you don't know about. And gosh, you know, the analogy would be like, you know, like fruit on a vine. If you stay there too long, you'd start to rot.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I resonate with that. I see a lot of sort of, I already know when it comes to dealing with other people. So, you know, and that's a tough one to break through, I found, but when we can crack that shell, all sorts of other stuff opens up. So let's say they have an employee who's not performing, and they already have sort of a diagnosis in their head. Oh, here, this is why. And typically it's, this is who they are. And tell me how to work with this person. And then the unspoken assumption underneath it is, given my assessment of who they are, because they have people pegged in their little boxes, and they also have themselves pegged in their little boxes. And it takes sometimes some real effort to break that open and get them to realize, I haven't asked that person a question in maybe years.
Yeah. And it goes actually even thing the other way around is when people say to me, well, Barry, my problem is it's my boss. It's always difficult to influence upward, and it's nearly impossible to get your boss fired. So when that question, I oftentimes sort of say, what do I have to do to change my behavior? If I can change my behavior, I'm liable to be able to change my boss's behavior or that person's behavior down there. So your example was, so what question do you want to ask that person that you haven't asked them before? Change your behavior.
Yep.
Or what do I need to, you know, I don't like this way that my boss behaves. So what do, instead of saying to my boss, well, why don't you behave differently? Knowing that that's the way that my boss behaves, what do I have to do? And then, of course, what am I willing to do? You know, maybe I'm not willing to do that. You know, my boss likes to have everything in writing. I don't like doing that. So why doesn't my boss change? Or more easily, why don't I say, well, I guess that's the way my boss is. And I guess if I want to influence him or her, I need to put this stuff in writing and stop aggravating myself about why does he make me put that in writing?
Yeah. Got it. Thank you. Kind of circling back and moving towards wrapping up in the interest of time, of course, we've established that the five leadership practices have, you know, withstood the test of time. And basically there's a real argument to be made that, you know, leadership, that the essentials of leadership, that really doesn't change. The context within which it happens might change, but leadership itself is fairly stable. And I think your work sort of bears that out. But I am curious, how over the past 40 years your thinking about leadership has changed. What's been the biggest shift for you in your thinking about leadership?
It's really hard to do. It's really challenging, you know. So the jaded journalist who asked me, well, why do you have to write another edition? You know, it's like, because it's hard. The stuff is hard to do. In my own experience as a leader in higher education, I don't always get it right, or just ask my wife. I don't know. She says, you write books about this stuff, you know.
Yeah, I can relate. Yeah,
this stuff is hard. It's hard to do, and it's getting harder. I mean, you know, that's what I said. You know, when you in a hybrid remote environment, it's harder. It takes more time and energy to do this stuff. The speed of information has made it more difficult to set a good example, to always be on your best behavior. Gosh, you know, maybe 40 years ago you could hide, but now, you know, everybody's going to record everything you do and say.
Yep.
So you need to be perhaps, I don't know, you need to be more clear about what it is that you want to say, so that you don't have to think so much about what you want to say. You've already thought about it, and then you can say it. which is interesting because research shows we trust people who talk fast more than we trust people who talk slow.
Yeah. Wonder
why he's talking so slowly. Why can't he just say what he wants to say?
In
closing, this gives me a chance to without embarrassment quote our newest book.
Excellent. Yeah, please.
Which is in production, comes out this May. It's called the second edition of the book Encouraging the Heart. Of the five practices, we've only written a book about one of the practices that we thought we really needed to spend more time with. And we wrote that book in 1990 called Encouraging the Heart. And we spent more time than we could in the book, The Leadership Challenge. And so, you know, 30 years later, we decided that that was still an important issue. And so Encouraging the Heart comes out, the second edition comes out, you know, 30 years later with, again, a lot of similar stuff. But the real essence of that book this time around is to make the point that that you've got to make sure that people know that they matter, that you get them. You know, I see you. You know, so much of what leaders need to be able to communicate, and you see this in politicians. You know, the people are responding to somebody that says, "I get you, I understand you." That's really a very visceral emotion that people have today and want to have today, and that's kind of a real meta point that comes into this new edition, that Encouraging the Heart is to let people know that they're not taken for granted, that they're not being ignored, that they're not being heard or listened to, that I, as your leader, you know, I get you, I understand you, I appreciate you, I acknowledge you, I see you. All those things are so very important. So, Romer, thank you for letting me tell that story.
Thank you, and thank you for sort of ending on that note that leadership really is a matter of the heart. Not that there's no head involved, but let's not forget the heart, because without it, it's empty, and people aren't gonna step into it. Barry Posner, thank you so very much for your time. I really enjoyed the conversation, and who knows, maybe our paths will cross again. Thank you.
Let's hope so. Thank you.
Thank you.